if a person rejected the development, he rejected it because it went too far on the same path, very clearly in the same path, it went too far, rather than it being something, it being something else, sorry about that, being something other than the original. He would know that the statement was homogeneous with the first statement. The second statement is homogeneous with the first statement. Same nature is the first statement. But he would say, if he did reject it, he would say it went too far. He would not say that the second statement was some other kind of nature, a statement with a different kind of nature. He would recognize it was the same nature, but he'd say, it's too much to say that. It's not right. But the Nietzschean ethic can be accepted only if we are ready to scrap traditional morals as a mere error and then put ourselves in a position where we can find no ground for any value judgments at all. And I wish I knew more of the specifics here. But he is saying that it is the difference between a man who says to us, you like your vegetables moderately fresh, why not grow your own and have them perfectly fresh? And a man who says, throw away that loaf and try eating bricks and centipedes instead. That you've come up with a whole new thing. A whole new thing, heterogeneous, of a different kind of nature. It's a different nature from the original.
If you really bless Nietzsche.
Yeah. So does Howard Hung in the margin of the thing. Howard on the page before, he said, the Tao is not one among a series of possible systems of value. It is the sole source of all value judgment. If it is rejected, all value is rejected. And Howard just says, what would N say? And I'd say, who's N? And then on the next page, there's N, Nietzsche. Okay. I want to say something that about ideologies, and it's just a marginal note. In a sense, ideologies are restatements of a part of the Tao felt to have not gone far enough. This is a marginal note. This is not an explanation of what Lewis is saying. It's another idea. Well, when we create ideologies, not like a Nietzschean ideology, which is a mere innovation, some whole new ball game. Whatever Nietzsche did, it apparently was not homogeneous to the Tao, but heterogeneous. Some new, whole new kind of value thing. But most of us and the new ideologies are restatements of a part of the Tao felt to have not gone far enough. We feel like equality has not gone far enough, is not big enough branch of the Tao. So we're going to make it big, the big one. We're going to come up with, say, communism. You know? Okay, we're going to take an ideology, and you're going to look at the Tao and see one of those things. It's not big enough. We're going to take it, we want to make it bigger. We feel like it wasn't big enough before. It hadn't gone far, rather than having gone too far, it hadn't gone far enough, and we kind of force-feed this thing, this part. We move one thing forward, but as we move one thing forward, what happens? That we are no longer side by side but limiting, which is the nature of the Tao. Everything side by side but limiting, to keep the whole in line. But as we create a new ideology, we move the, I think, and this is all my own speculation in the margin, I think one of the things we're doing is moving that one thing forward. We're not saying, you know, that there is not value, and we don't want to admit that we're doing anything bad to the Tao. We're just moving that one precept forward. And as we move that one precept forward, we soon forget that we are no longer in a side-by-side and limiting relationship with the other precepts, and in isolation from the other precepts, it bloats and it becomes madness.
What do you mean by side-by-side but limiting?
That's what he says. Always, that's what Lewis says about the Tao. It's a couple, twice he said it before. That each precept, you know, we say, and the precept to take care of our kids, we also have the sibits, and that value there's also the need for justice that is stand side by side and limiting the initial one about taking care of your kin, okay? And then side by side by that is the brotherhood of man, okay? And so each of the values is limited in a way by the others. We can't just say that's the whole thing and then it just goes crazy. That one is the whole thing. Those who understand the spirit of the Tao and who have been led by that spirit can modify it in directions which that spirit itself demands. Those who understand the spirit of the Tao.
Okay,
the spirit of the Tao. It's like getting inside the language, the spirit of the language. And who have been led by that spirit can modify it in directions which that spirit itself demands. Only they can know what those directions are. Only they can know what those directions are. And that's why that crazy scent thing I said before, somehow the only way to see how the present spoken Tao is not the absolute. The door. Well, what did I say again? Said it better before. This morning. About absolutes. Almost in it. The doorway, you go through, you get into the Tao to change it, is the acceptance of the Tao as the absolute. The precepts of the Tao as absolute. And the way one gets, and that acceptance is the doorway into the Tao where once in, you can see some changes.
Do you modify the Tao or do you modify the
articulation of the Tao? I think the principles are there. And boy, they don't change much either, do they? You know, in terms of the articulation. The outsider knows nothing about the matter. His attempts at alteration, as we have seen, can contradict themselves. So far from being able to harmonize discrepancies in its letter by penetration, to its spirit, he merely snatches it some one precept on which the accidents of time and place happen to have riveted his attention, and then rides it to death. For no reason that he can give. We gotta read that one again, don't we? This person who criticizes from the outside does not have is not working with the spirit. Let's say instead of the guy who doesn't is outside, the guy who is inside by penetrating, going deep into the spirit of the Tao, is capable to harmonize discrepancies in its letters the letter of the law, the spirit of the law. You've heard that, right? It's not the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law that this will take place in court, say. Being gracious is where you don't demand the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law, the individual law. And that happens in courtrooms sometimes. Now, the guy who stands outside is not capable of doing that. So far from being able to harmonize discrepancies in its letter by penetration to its spirit, still he wants to change it. And so he snatches at some one precept. He snatches at one precept. And what is his criteria for picking and choosing? He grabs a precept on which the accidents of time and place happen to have riveted his attention, and then rides it to death. Now remember that time frame business? The accidents of time and place, his own particular situation at this short, you know, at that smaller piece of time. And then he picks that, and then he rides it to death. Now, in some ways, our understandings of democracy are that way. Certain accidents of time and place have caused us to value certain aspects of democracy far above other values. So that right to choose is more important than anything else. That value of the right to choose. That's the highest value. And away from being limited by these other values, you know, that one value bloats itself to madness and isolation from the whole picture becomes a real problem. We can see that effect on this stress, I think, on the equal right to vote in South Africa. And we think we can see that. And somehow that's the highest value. And we can really think that for a long time. And we can move and push and be sure that that's done as quickly as possible. So important. You know, and I think if it happened, we'd see right in about 2 minutes that, oh my gosh, we forgot about this value, and this value, and this value, and this value, and this one. Also the business on the abortion thing. Somehow the accidents of time and place rivet our attention on one precept of the Tao, and that's by far the most important thing. You know, we'll think. We don't even think that the other value is limited at all. No, nope, that's the thing. That's the most important thing. And then we can get caught in that situation, so, you know, good heavens, what happened? But the thing is, too, that then we pick that one, rivet attention, ride it to death, and we can't give any real good reason why we have picked that one, to pick and choose again. Right? You don't have a criteria for picking and choosing with the Tao. Not any good reason. You've got some explanations, accidents of time and place, but you don't have any good reasons to support that heightening, moving that one forward. From within the Tao itself comes the only authority to modify the Tao. From within the Tao itself comes the only authority to modify the Tao. This is what Confucius meant when he said, with those who follow a different way, it is useless to take counsel. Well, I don't really, let's see, how do I work that? You can't get outside. The view from outside of the Tao is not going to help you modify the Tao from within. Okay, because it has to come from within. Somebody who is following a different way can't get in there. You know, can't get in there.
It's more of an extension than a modification.
Well, it's a surgical change. He can tell you drop that and lop that off and lop that off and lop that off. But He can't change it from within, that organic change. You have to be inside, you know, to change it the way it can change. This is why Aristotle said that only those who have been well brought up can usefully study ethics. To a corrupted man, the man who stands outside the Tao, the very starting point of his science is invisible. There's those kittens again. Starting point of that... Hello there.
Hi, Jack.
Starting point of that science is invisible. Kitten can't see the vertical. Hasn't been learned the basic values, aesthetic values earlier, say. He may not be hostile. He may be hostile, but he cannot be critical. He does not know what is being discussed. Now that one there, the person outside the Tao can be hostile. But he cannot be in any real sense critical. He can't give a meaningful criticism. He does not really know what is being discussed. That is why it was also said, this people that knoweth not the law is accursed. This people that knoweth not the law is accursed. That's from the Gospel of John. And Jesus said that to the Jews.
What was that quote from T.S. Eliot, there's no greater chasm?
No greater chasm that separates man than the chasm between those who accept revelation and those who do not.
So we could say that it accepts the Tao.
Yeah, that there is a... That
there's no way they can
begin. Mm-hmm. And then it said in Mark, the other gospel, another thing that this fellow Jesus said, he that believeth not shall be damned. He that believeth not shall be damned. Now, he that believeth not shall be damned, talking in terms of the Tao. He that believeth not in that is damned. He who knows not the law is accursed, and he who believes not the law is damned. An open mind in questions that are not ultimate is useful. Here's his big zinger. An open mind in questions that are not ultimate is useful. But an open mind about the ultimate foundations, either of theoretical or practical reason, is idiocy. Put them together, move them a little closer. Open-minded idiocy. If a man's mind is open on these things, let his mouth at least be shut. Bong. A man's mind is open on these things, let his mouth at least be shut. He can say nothing to the purpose. Outside the Tao, there is no ground for criticizing either the Tao or anything else. I mean, criticism is too powerful a thing to be done without standing in, surrounded by values which are limiting, where your criticism is limited and you have to keep a balance. In particular instances, it may no doubt be a matter of some indelicacy to decide where the legitimate internal criticism ends and the fatal external kind begins. In particular instances, it may no doubt be a matter of some delicacy, difficulty and delicacy to decide where the legitimate internal criticism ends and the fatal external kind begins. But wherever any precept of traditional morality is simply challenged to produce its credentials. Okay, this is just, you know, get this and think about this quite a bit. And any precept of traditional morality is simply challenged to produce its credentials as though the burden of proof were on it. We have taken the wrong position. And we do that. I've got 100 times I've done that. And it was wrong to do it. So there's some interesting arguments, you know, to, well, why shouldn't I? with some guy having a talk once. Why shouldn't I smoke dope at Holden, you know, these drugs up here? And I says, well, why should you? Give me an argument. Why should you? Can't. Well, then don't. Don't worry about it. It's a bad habit to get into, putting the burden of proof on every, you know, thinking that traditional morality is to be challenged. Produce its credentials.
Where does the burden of proof lie if it doesn't lie there? It
lies on me. If I think that if a traditional morality or for traditional value bothers me, then the burden of proof is on me. It's my job. But I can't just sit there and say, because if I know the burden of proof is on me, I've got to go in the Tao to talk about it. If I think the burden of proof is on the morality, I'm outside the Tao. Never have to go in it. I can just sit out there and, you know, spit on it, really, and laugh at it. The legitimate reformer endeavors to show that the precept in question conflicts with some precept which its defenders allow to be more fundamental. Okay. The legitimate reformer. I mean, if traditional morality bothers you, then you endeavor to show that the precept in question conflicts with some precept which its defenders allow to be more fundamental. That you, this is sort of like rhetoric. We've talked a little about this in rhetoric. What is the value, and then show that value is not being valued enough by somebody that you disagree with.
That's what Luther did too.
Mm-hmm.
He went back to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Or that it does not really embody the judgment of value it professes to embody. Or the statement of it does not really embody the vision of it. The direct frontal attack, why, what good does it do, who said so, is never permissible, not because it's harsh or offensive, but because no values at all can justify themselves on that level. That's why he went through that big problem, you know, all that stuff we were doing today, you know, to show that. No values can justify themselves on that level. No ought can produce in this credential. So don't waste your time asking them to.
Level 2 thinking recognizes
the why, what good does it do, who said so?
Yeah.
I think it, you could call it that.
What
did
you say?
I think even maybe grade 3 or 1 or whatever. 1, 3, 3. Sort of the kind of thinking that is really feeling. I don't want to. Who said so? See? I don't want to. It's a feeling thing. It's not a thinking thing. So that's that first level, or the third. One goes up. One is better in one, and fourth, and then the... Oh, I don't even know anymore. Who cares? But anyway, the kind of thought, the guy that says this is who cares here, I think is the one that says, I don't want to follow that traditional morality. And then he moves from that knowledge to, okay, who said so? And what's causing him to say who said so is that his feelings cause that, not his thoughts. But it would be the lowest level of thinking. Golding would say grade 3. I remember that now. And then it's funny how this comes in. How what he's been talking about for 50 pages seems to can almost bang at us here. Who said so? It's never permissible, not because it's harsh or offensive, but because no values at all can justify themselves on that level. And you go, bang. Sometimes you can hear that no ought can produce in his credential or should be expected to. Maybe this is the first place we hear it. Well, we wouldn't have heard it here if we hadn't have banged, you know, plowed through that other stuff. If you persist in that kind of trial, you will destroy all values and so destroy the basis of your own criticism as well as the thing criticized. You must not hold a pistol to the head of the Tao, nor must we postpone obedience to a precept until its credentials have been examined. The burden of proof is on us. We obey.
Nor must we postpone obedience until its credentials have been examined. And then the next sentence too, one of those that are practicing Tao will understand it. It's like the conservative and reformed Jews who feel that a lot of practices are
meaningless
now. Just should cut them out, and then the Orthodox will argue, well, they seem meaningless, but they don't mean anything until you do it.
Exactly.
You don't understand it until you practice.
That's exactly what he's saying here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly, that you can't know. And I think one thing, for your own sake and your own frustrations, mm-hmm. in your conversations with people sometimes who are on the outside of this, you know, you can't talk. Why do you keep missing each other? I mean, keep the connection with the people, keep talking with them, but don't expect a great deal unless they get inside the Tao.
Well,
nor must we postpone obedience to a precept until its credentials have been examined. Only those who are practicing the Tao will understand it. It is the well-nurtured man, the good genteel, and he alone who can recognize reason when it comes, which is the statement from Plato. It is Paul, the Pharisee, the man perfect as touching the law, who learned where and how the law was deficient. Moving right along, in order to avoid misunderstanding, okay, we can come back to that, but the man perfect, Plato talked about it, and then Paul, the Pharisee, a man perfect is touching the law, who could say to people who knew him, I was perfect touching the law, and they would agree. Okay? I mean, he said those things in public. He's an interesting fellow, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Perfect is touching the law, who learns where and how the law was deficient. In order to avoid misunderstanding, I may add that although I am a theist, and indeed a Christian, I am not here attempting any indirect argument for theism. I'm simply arguing that if we are to have values at all, we must accept the ultimate platitudes of practical reason as having absolute validity. And there's the word, absolute validity, the word that we hate so much, that any attempt, having become skeptical about these, to introduce value lower down or on some supposedly more realistic basis is doomed. That's the key to what he's doing in this whole book, at least so far, okay? This is what he's saying. And he said everything else to get this point across. Whether this position implies a supernatural origin for the Tao is a question I am not here concerned with. I believe we go to the last page now. To This is the whole first phase. What time is it, by the way? My watch stopped.
20 to 10.
Let's take a break and come back. But I'll leave you with one thing as you walk out the door. About that, don't hold a pistol to the head of the Tao, you know. If you pull the trigger, you blow your brains out. But you must not hold a pistol to the head of the Tao. Who holds... Different. I don't know if this MC, I feel like this is so close to heresy, I don't even want to say it. Would it be meaningful to say that someone puts the Tao to our heads and pulls the trigger? And would it be meaningful to say, if it's meaningful to say that, would it be meaningful to say that that is someone, the same person that accuses us, or someone else? Is he who accuses us the specific breakings of the law the same as someone else who may put the Tao to our head and pull the trigger? Let's let that be a Zen koan, because we can't talk about Christ anymore. Let's take a break for 10 minutes and get the blood going on.
I have lots of question marks around, but some specific ones. Does he use the Tao in two different ways? One to mean the principle, and one to mean the spoken verbalization of it. And when he talks about altering it, he talks about altering the verbalization of it.
He is not specifying. You know, he doesn't stop and make that distinction. And yet, what he's saying about the Tao and changing the Tao is we can make that sort of footnote, I think. I think it's
so
legitimate.
We can say it,
because he does say the principle in that one statement on 58, about in the middle. Accepting the old would at once recognize the new as an extension of the same principle. The principle, in other words, we say the principle behind a statement, okay?
Yeah.
And then that's where I brought up the thing on Lao Tse,
mm-hmm.
having said, well, no one, the real Tao cannot be spoken.
What's Lao Tse?
He's one of the Chinese, I believe, thinkers, Lao Tse. And he of all these other names for the Tao, he was the one that wrote the Tao. I mean, that's his word. Lao Tse's, the Tao. And I can't remember how it worked. The context of his saying the real Tao cannot be spoken or written was... I think that's the last statement of his statement of the Tao. After writing down all the precepts of the Tao, the last one is, the real Tao cannot be written, spoken. That's one of the principles, precepts of the Tao, is the real Tao cannot be spoken, see? Or written down.
Seems funny that Lewis didn't tell us that.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's saying it in terms of extension, the same principle, but I think that would involve him, I think, into an explanation of what we did, and it slows down what he's saying. I mean, he's already had to do that a number of times, hasn't he? He says, but wait. And then he goes on and tells you about the two kinds of criticism. But wait. And then he gets to his thing. When you're writing something, he's doing enough. He's got to go around the elephant in a short length of time, and he's going to try to, and he does it. So he can't mention everything. He can footnote this in the sense that he's written huge books of footnotes, I mean, or essays, many footnote essays on the same principles that he's talking about here. It'd get more specific. But he uses it essentially in one way, intending people to understand that the verbal, maybe he believes his audience understands that there's a principle behind a rule, and then we try to conform that rule to the principle, that vision, the language to the vision.
Okay.
What's the other one? You had another? Or was that the
main? No, I just had a bunch of questions all
around.
The same thing.
Related to that. The and no values can justify themselves on these credentials. Now, there's a note I have, and I'll mention it later. I don't know if I've got enough brain cells left to talk about it too much now, but it's a note, and I think it's something that you... I think it's true. And it's that God littered the universe with evidence, 50-50. Evidence for these precepts of the Tao. 50 for, 50 against. You can't prove it, you can't disprove it. God's littered the world with evidence, 50-50. So that salvation is earned by the heart alone in its vision, but not by an argument. That's how God leaves our freedom whole.
Could you repeat that last?
God leaves our freedom whole by littering the universe with evidence, 50-50. For these precepts. So that salvation is earned by the heart alone in its vision. In other words, how could I be free? If God were proved.
Yeah.
There's no freedom. I have to. Necessary. How could I be freely embrace the precepts of the Tao if they were proved? I'd have to. There's no freedom there. It's necessary. Somehow that principle of freedom really is important to God. And then it's so ironic that we, in the name of freedom, we leave him. When that he wants that, he values that freedom a great deal. Anyway, I feel that that's related to this acceptance of the Tao business. It doesn't want us to be proven, but he cares so much about the precepts of the Tao, he doesn't want it to be disproven either. You can't disprove it. You can't prove it. You have to accept it or not. And the grounds of your acceptance is in some ways going to be where your heart is.
Okay.
and who's at the center of your universe. Okay? And accepting part, then he can show. You've got to accept all of it. You can't just take bits and pieces. You can't pick and choose. That's a hard message. I was raised to pick and choose. I was raised to value pick and choosing. You know? That was the high, you know, the highest value, that choice. I can choose all these things. But we are inside. Now, inside that Tao, we're caught in demands, that sense of going one way at a time. How can we go more than one way at a time? I have a call to be home now. I have a duty to be home now. A duty to put my children to sleep. To bed. See? To help them through the night without nightmares. I have a duty to, you know, my pregnant wife. I have a duty to you. I have a duty right at this moment of time to my sister in Hong Kong who I haven't written in over a year. You know, I have a duty. You know, I care about her a great deal. We get together and swore to her I was going to be writing her long letters. You know, haven't written her in a year. I have a duty there. I have a duty there. I have a duty to parents. I have a duty to develop what some talents in poetry that I've been given. I'm not doing it. I have a duty here. A duty to love. All over the place. That duty is there. A call, a demand. Love. You know, we're in situations like that. Now, the book is saying it is not our job to say we aren't, so that we can sleep easier. Yeah. God might want us to sleep easier, but he doesn't want us to arrive to that sleeping easier in certain ways. Like silencing the Tao, picking and choosing, and justifying, not doing, not conforming to the Tao. He wants us to stay there in the Tao, facing all those situations. That business of killing that I've mentioned about the CO thing, he doesn't want, I have to face the fact that I was wrong. See? In what I would do, probably kill a guy. I'm wrong. I'm dead wrong. I have to face the whole Tao. I cannot go around justifying it. By being in harmony with one precept of the Tao, I do not get in harmony with other ones, all the other ones. So I'm in this state, and it can be really painful. And that's not just can be, you know, is a lot of the time. Is all of the time in 32 AD. You know, well, what? That's real. No rationalization possible. No picking and choosing. Well, that isn't relevant to me, and that isn't, and that isn't, and that isn't, and that isn't. And this is the only one relevant to me, my situation, due to my accident of time and place. This is the one that's relevant to me. And the rest I can shut up. You know. And this is the only precept of the Tao that I have to go in, and then I can feel good about myself. No rationalization possible.
Now is this just, I guess for one place that I have trouble with that is, okay, if that was just myself, that I will say those things to myself, but that I have to look at every one and I can't just pick
mm-hmm.
which one is relative to me at this point. But when other people...
Well, you have to, in a sense, see what you're most relevant to your situation, but there's no silencing the other one.
Yeah.
The contrary demands, and we are in a situation where we're demanded to be many more places than we can be. Yeah.
Well, is this where maybe where a lot of people will say that all is relative because so many people try to put a judgment on another person and say, when this person has this terrible decision to make,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
has to go one way, such as an abortion or something
mm-hmm.
like that,
mm-hmm.
and then you have all these other people that start yelling at you and say, you're so wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong,
mm-hmm.
and because this
precept of the Tao,
this
says,
is the one that you have to consider, mm-hmm. and this is the most important one in your case, and someone else will say, this one is the most important,
mm-hmm.
and when, you know, what do you do with that? For yourself, you have to decide. Sorry, I'm going to get confused, but...
No, you're not. Go ahead.
Well, just where... I just lost everything.
That does tend to happen, you know, at this point in the discussion. But what... I guess, rather than to say you're wrong, you know, point the finger. If say you're in a situation like that, rather than to point the finger there, you're wrong like that. To point to the Tao, precept of the Tao. There's this, and there's this, and there's this, so that you are in the Tao. And not justifying yourself by picking one of the precepts of the Tao and conforming to it and saying that that is justifying your choice.
Well,
not to justify. Now, if I'm pointing fingers at you, I'm forcing you to justify yourself. It's not good for you to justify yourself. The greatest just thing, if I want to justify myself, the first thing I find is what? The Tao. I grab one precept. Now, I'm covered. I'm protected. Because I'm living up to this part of the Tao. See? And that justification, I can't force you, I should not, as a human being, force you into justifying your position. I do, and you're going to tear one branch off the Tao and justify yourself. I can't allow you, I can't. That's a bad thing to do for you. It's a bad thing to teach you, though, to do that as a response to your situation, to say, hey, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Let's erase this Tao out here. And that leaves you with that one thing, and now you go ahead, and it's going to be all right. I think it's wrong to do that, too. In the situation of abortion, the person knows better. Something inside knows better. It will cause a repression that's going to pop up again later. Now, does that speak to what your question is?
Yeah. So then, okay, the person who is just really feels very strongly about that everything is relative, also could be a reaction to the kind of when we try to pick part of it and say that this is it, this is what you do in this situation, and you don't look at any other parts of the Tao.
I think people who consider themselves moral people have in many ways helped whip people into the position of relativism. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I'm just trying to
see.
Yeah,
I can force you. If I go around and I find the, you know, the one branch of the Tao that happens to be something that I'm good at, and I whip everybody else, and they see that that is not the most important
mm-hmm.
thing,
yeah,
then they're going to say it's relative. Now, come on.
Mm-hmm.
You know. How does traditional morality get such a bad name? Traditional morality, all you got to say traditional morality and you get the creeps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Well, this book, whole book, is about traditional morality. That's all it's about. He's looking behind it and saying, hey, that's really good. But people who consider themselves to be traditionally moral have done some pretty stinky things. They've felt that they've been righteous. They've taken branches of the Tao off and whipped people with them. And you don't break branches off the Tao and whip people with them. The tree does the whipping by itself. Mm-hmm. And I point to the Tao. Mm-hmm. Now in dealing with you in a situation like that, and for you is to look to the whole Tao and to know that you're not going to be righteous. Someone who's inside the Tao knows that. No one within the Tao says he's a good man. No one. Can't even approximate it. Religious man never will say that. When you're within the Tao, you never will say that. Now, we people can be in and then out again. And then they can say it, and then they can be in and then they jump out again. And then they, you know, they say it. But you can't be in the Tao and say, I've been a good man. There's no way that that can happen. There is about 80% of me resists that completely. You know, I don't want to say that. I don't want to think that is so. Because damn it, then I'm hurting. I want to be able to say that I'm good. I want to be able to say that I'm justified. I want to be able to say that I'm righteous. Don't we? We'll come up with all sorts of things to try to enable us to say that, and we'll even interpret the gospel in such a way that we think that we have justification by proof. And what does the statement say? Justification by proofs? Justification by faith. You know? But we don't want that. We want to say justified. To see here my proof, this precept of the Tao. Got it. One thing about that Tao and breaking things off, you know, one branch of the Tao can fit our hands. You know, we got an instinct that we want to embrace the Tao. Good. We've got little hands. And that tree is huge. And we break a branch off, something that fits our hands. And we can think there for a while that we have done it. We have embraced the truth. This is it. Freedom. This is it. Just demands. This is it. Independence. This is it. You know, one thing after another. We can feel like that's the deal. But what happens is that it started out all right. I mean, that sense, that desire to embrace the Tao, and we took a quick look at our hands, grabbed a piece of it, and we wanted to say that that was enough. And pretty soon it withers, and we wither, or we bloat to madness, this kind of thing, in isolation from the rest of the Tao. When you want to embrace the Tao and you face it, the whole thing, you get on your knees. You know, we want to be equal to the Tao, and so we make the Tao equal to us. We don't want to be humble, to be on our knees in the face of that Tao. We don't want that to happen. Something in us perhaps the adversary of the human spirit. What is it? The adversary of the human being. The adversary of the human being. We don't want to say that we're not human beings. If the Tao is what's telling us what the attitudes that a human being has, if we're in the Tao, then we know that we don't have those attitudes all the time. And we're even caught in sort of varying and pulled in different directions. We say that we aren't, well, we aren't human beings. We don't want to admit that. And the irony is that it's the adversary of the human being that tells us not to believe that. And he comes in the form of an advocate of the human being. You are a human being. You are there. Whereas the real advocate of the human being is telling us that we're not human. We aren't grown up. We have to grow up. And I'm 31 and I've got to grow up. Somebody must think I'm a child. Yep. See? That's exactly the point. We're children. If we have a father in heaven, we're children. We're not growing up yet. Now the thing on we want to feel that we're good. We feel that we can think that the gospel is something that tells us that we are good and we're justified by proof, so forth. And we get, there's not a good man left. No, not one. There is not one who understands, not one who looks for God. All have turned aside, tainted all alike. There is not one good man left, not a single one. Their throats are yawning graves, their tongues are full of deceit, vipers' venom is on their lips, bitter curses fill their mouths, their feet are swift with blood. When blood is to be shed, wherever they go, there is havoc and ruin. They know nothing of the way of peace, and there is no fear of God before their eyes. Christ, when told he was a good man, you know, don't call me good. Christ said that. No man is good. That's the gospel. What is the relationship to that, to the gospel? What is the relationship of the gospel to this law which seems to squeeze the very life out of me? You know. I mean, this Tao, not one bit of it is going to be erased, he says. Well, what is the relationship of Christ to this? I mean, in a sense, this book, the weight of this book, the heaviness of this book, is that that law starts to take on. I liked it better as an abstraction, you know. I don't like it better if you're telling, you know, if it's concretely showing me that I'm screwed up, that I'm sick, that I might be the one that God might have to come for. It's like a furnace where we can't jump out, or we become apes in pants, brains in bottles, you know. A brain in a bottle or an ape in pants. You know, those two images. We get that point of open-minded idiocy, you know, Yet it's very hot in the Tao. It's a very hot position to be in. We're burning. And what? How do we respond to that? Do we jump out of the frying pan into the fire? How can we survive in the Tao? It is said that it's supposed to, it's beautiful, remember? It's beautiful. That's the picture. And yet it's crushing me. Does Christ tell me to jump out, or does something else happen? And that, I guess an image. An image for me of what my situation, or the relationship between me and the Tao, the law, and Christ, is clarified by that crazy story in Daniel of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar put him in the furnace. Remember? You don't know that story?
I do.
Okay. Shadrach, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, addressed them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is it true that you have not, that you do not serve my gods, and that you refuse to worship the golden statue I have erected? When you hear the sound of horn, pipe, lyre, so forth, so forth, are you prepared to prostrate yourself and worship the statue I have made? If you refuse to worship it, you know, you must be thrown straight into the fire, burning fiery furnace. If you refuse to worship this in a sense idol, this one, you know, probably a fertility god, this one sort of aspect of the Tao that Nebuchadnezzar has taken across. Now worship this one thing. And the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, your question hardly requires an answer. If our God, the one we serve, is able to save us from the burning fiery furnace and from your power, O King, he will save us. And if he does not, then you must know, O King, that we will not serve your God or worship the statue you have erected anyway. These words infuriated the king. He gave orders for the furnace to be made 7 times hotter than usual. This is the way he tortured people, got rid of people. And he commanded certain stalwarts from his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them in the burning fiery furnace. They were bound, fully clothed, cloak, hose, and headgear, and thrown into the burning fiery furnace. The king's command was so urgent that the heat of the furnace was so fierce that the men carrying Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were burnt to death by the flames from the fire. The 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell, still bound, into the burning fiery furnace. And they walked in the heart of the flames, and they walked in the heart of the flames, praising God and blessing the Lord. All honor, and this is what they said, all honor and blessing to you, God, Lord, God of our ancestors. May your name be held glorious forever. In all that you have done, your justice is apparent. Your promises are always faithfully fulfilled. Your ways never deviate. Your judgments are always true. You have given a just sentence. In all the disasters you have brought down on us and on Jerusalem, the holy city of our ancestors. Since it is for our sins that you have treated us like this. Since it is for our sins that you have treated us like this fairly and as we have deserved. Yet we have sinned and committed a crime by deserting you. Yes, we have sinned gravely. We have not listened to the precepts of your law. We have not listened to the precepts of your law. We have not observed them. We have not done what we were told to do for our own good. Yes, all the disasters you have brought down on us, all that you have done to us, you have been justified in doing. But may the contrite soul, the humbled spirit, be as acceptable to you as the holocaust of rams and bullocks and thousands of fattened lambs. Such let our sacrifice be to you today, and may it be your will that we follow you wholeheartedly, since those who put their trust in you will not be disappointed. And now we put our whole heart into following you. We put our whole heart into following you, into fearing you and seeking your face once more. Do not disappoint us. Treat us gently as you yourself are gentle and very merciful. Grant us deliverance worthy of your wonderful deeds. Let your name win glory, Lord. And all three in unison in the fire began to sing, glorifying and blessing God. There in the furnace, in these words, may you be blessed, Lord God of our ancestors, be praised and extolled forever. Blessed be your glorious and holy name, praised and extolled forever. May you be blessed in the temple of your sacred glory, blessed on the throne of your kingdom. Blessed, you fathomer of the great depths, enthroned on the cherubs. Blessed in the vault of heaven, exalted and glorified above all forever and ever. Two pages of blessings. Everything that grows on the earth, bless the Lord. Springs of water, bless the Lord. Seas and rivers, bless the Lord. Sea beasts and everything that lives in the water. On and on and on and on. In the fiery furnace. For you have snatched us from the underworld, saved us from the hand of death, saved us from the burning fiery furnace, rescued us from the heart of the flame. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, and his love is everlasting. All you who worship him, bless the God of gods, praise him and give him thanks, for his love is everlasting. What happened in the furnace, you know? But the angel of the Lord came down into the furnace, and he drove the flames of the fire outwards, and fanned into them in the heart of the furnace a coolness such as wind and dew will bring, so that the fire did not even touch them, or cause them any pain or distress. But they were inside. They were inside that. And they didn't jump out. But not something Christ gets in the furnace with us, okay? And there we are. And what was this thing that could destroy us without him becomes something else. Something, the law that crushed us becomes, as Paul says, the most beautiful thing there is. The most beautiful thing there is. And yet without Christ being there, you can't stand to look it in the face. And without that defect is actual and specific, concrete. The violation of that, we have not followed the law. And the wrongness of that is the context of meaning for the gospel. There isn't any other context. We're in this a weird position of having to be converted to the law before we can be reconverted to Christianity. And that's crazy. But that's true. I don't know if it made any sense, that thing about the don't hold the pistol to the head of the doll, you know. And then saying that, you know, the accuser, Satan means accuser. Did you know that? The word Satan means accuser. The one that accuses. Satan does that. He somehow has used the most beautiful thing that God has made to poke us and to jab us and to kill us. to make us run away from the most beautiful thing. But it's always Satan that does the accusing. In a sense, I don't know if this... Satan points the finger at us. And Christ points the finger at the Tao. And says, look at this. Look at this. He doesn't accuse by pointing the finger at us. He points out certain realities to us. And that's enough. Another thing he does... He gets it over with. He says, you're dead. You know, dead. Instead of blowing our brains out. Hope for righteousness. From proof. And that is the basic theme of the gospel. Die. Unless a seed fall on the ground and die, it cannot have life. Okay? As far as my a lively righteousness that is mine by proof in the Tao, that dies. Don't. That's over. That's not the point. And dying like that is a kind of life. Now, pretty much back to that, there is no enabling power in knowing the Tao. Power's got to come from somewhere else. There's no enabling power in knowing what's... That produces... The Tao produces a state of St. Paul, wretched man that I am. And then, and that's realized. Not just sort of, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Realized. It's true for me, existentially, true for me. Then Christ can actually come and touch. And much of our time is spent keeping him away. I was staying away from the very context of meaning and where he comes. And trying to justify by proof. Be right, you know. Be righteous by proof. Be good by proof. And we use, just as the Tao can be a great most, you can sin against the Tao best by grabbing one of the precepts. The gospel itself, misunderstood, is the greatest weapon and the greatest means to keep ourselves from the gospel. And so it's Kierkegaard's saying, you know, the best last refuge from God is religion, where it's no longer faith and actuality, it's some sort of system that we make. And story is that things are much worse than we ever dreamed and much better. And unless we know that, we don't know much. And let's call it for tonight. We'll talk some more tomorrow. Let that simmer in the tissues. The last page of the second chapter is really the first page of the third, so we'll go on with that tomorrow. There's one other thing I could read. This is from Romans 7:7. Does it follow that the law itself is sin? Of course not. What I mean is that I should not have known what sin was except for the law. I should not, for instance, have known what it means to covet if the law had not said you shall not covet. But it was not, but was this commandment that sin took advantage, but it was this commandment that sin took advantage of to produce all kinds of covetousness in me. For when there was no law, for where there is no law, sin is death. Once when there was no law, I was alive. But when the commandment came, sin came into my life, and I died. And the commandment was meant to lead me to life, but it turned out to mean death for me, because sin took advantage of the commandment to mislead me. And so sin, through that commandment, killed me. The law is sacred, and what it commands is sacred, just and good. Does that mean that something good killed me? Of course not. But sin, to show itself in its true colors, used that good thing to kill me, and thus sin, thanks to the commandment, was able to exercise all its sinful power. The law, of course, as we all know, is spiritual, but I am unspiritual. I have been sold as a slave to sin. I cannot understand my own behavior. I fail to carry out the things I want to do, and I find myself doing the very things I hate. When I act against my own will, that means I have a self that acknowledges that the law is good. And so the thing behaving in that way is not myself, but sin living in me. The fact is, I know of nothing good living in me, living, that is, in my unspiritual self. For though the will to do what is good is in me, the performance is not. The performance is not. With the result that instead of doing the good things I want to do, I carry out the sinful things I don't want to do. When I act against my will, then it is not my true self doing it, but sin which lives in me. In fact, this seems to be the rule, that every single time I want to do good, it is something evil that comes to hand. In my inmost self, I dearly love God's law, but I can see that my body follows a different law that battles against the law which my reason dictates. This is what makes me a prisoner of that law of sin which lives inside my body. What a wretched man I am. Who will rescue me from this body doomed to death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. In short, it is I who with my reason serve the law of God, and no less I who serve in my unspiritual self the law of sin. Then he goes on and talks about the life of the Spirit. The last two things in the Tao, in Lewis's book, when he talks about the Tao, of all the things the Norwegians, the Norskis, came up with a good one, didn't they? One 21. Is not the love of wisdom a practice of death? Is not the love of wisdom a practice of death? And then the thing from the Norskis, talking about that self, the selves. I know that I hung on the gallows for 9 nights, wounded with a spear, as a sacrifice to Odin. Myself offered to myself. Myself offered to myself. A strange statement. I hung on the cross 9 nights, wounded with a spear, as a sacrifice to their God, myself, offered to myself. Think of that in context with the Romans that we read. And then, verily, verily, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life loses it. He who loves his righteousness loses it. He who loves his justification loses it. He who loves his goodness loses it. And inside the Tao, you know you lost it. And so, there can be fruit in your life. That's about all I can up with the abolition of man. The guy who says, I want to do something. I know I can't prove it, I know there's nothing, but I just want to do something. Law is the context of meaning for the gospel. That was Romans 7, 7 through 25. But it goes on. That whole passage of Romans is an abolition of man thing. The numbers of chapters there. Numbers of chapters. In Romans, Paul just tackles this one right head on. It's a tough one to get. That business of looking to the good, the true, the noble. Sort of that's the health for man. We've got to look at it. And without Christ's forgiveness of sins, I can't look at it. I burn up. With the forgiveness of sins, I can look at it. I can recognize defect. I can't without the forgiveness of sins. There's no way that I can anything but artificially say that I'm defective. I can't really know it without the forgiveness of sins. And so, in a sense, those precepts of the law are like stars that guide us, aren't they? You know? And, to help us to know what it is to be human, and to know what to orient ourselves. And yet most of our common modern thought, you know, tells us not to look. And why do we have so damn much incoherence in our lives? Incoherence, which is the word that is sort of that underlying word through all of Tierney's Escape from Loneliness. Incoherence of life, incoherence of life, incoherence of life. And then when we of grabbing a branch of the Tao is like grabbing a falling star. As soon as we want to take it away, it becomes a falling star, and it guides us. You know, to nothingness. Okay. Well, let's go to bed.